Singleness, that's what we are here to talk about today. What are some attitudes in the world around singleness today? We see some of the extremes of apathy, antagonism, and even people applauding it for all the wrong reasons. Think of apathy for a moment. We are living in a day where people are getting married older and older, sometimes circumstantial due to studying and those sorts of things, but people are just the average. So in the 1960s, the average age for a woman was 18 and man was 20, and now it is average age is 28 for a woman and 30 for a man. That's the average age for marriage, which is an incredible move. In about half a century. People are losing their ability to relate to other people. So singles are struggling to relate to other singles, even to ask them out on a date, because they're so consumed with living online with their phones. And unfortunately, pornography has also filled a gap. But singleness is also applauded by some today for the wrong reasons. Some people view marriage as a relic of the patriarchy. Or maybe some today are influenced by Andrew Tate. Andrew Tate says that the modern Western male doesn't have to worry about marriage. He can get all the perks of marriage without the commitment. And it's an institution that doesn't serve up anything anymore. But there's also antagonism towards singleness. Loneliness is seen as a crime against humanity. And there's a certain entitlement that people have. I must be loved. I must be married. It is my God-given right. Is it? Today, loneliness is seen as a crime. And so, as a result, the single person is often seen as someone who is deficient, unwanted. Singleness, unfortunately, is seen by a shame which many bear in society today. This, too, is a wrong view of singleness. If we go back to the ancient world, there were also all sorts of wrong views around singleness. There were those who glorified it in the Vestal Virgins in Rome. There were others who thought that marriage was a distraction. The philosophers, the cynics, believed that marriage prevented you from becoming self-sufficient, and so you should avoid marriage so you could realize your own potential as an individual. You might even, that some of that language might be familiar today. In fact, Augustus Caesar penalized singleness. He wanted to increase the morality of Rome, so he made it basically illegal to be single by adding all sorts of penalties for those who pursued singleness instead of marriage, because he wanted to lift the morality of the Roman Empire. So there are so many wrong attitudes towards singleness. Well, we come now to the longest sustained discussion on singleness in the Bible. And what we see is a wonderfully balanced perspective. Paul and God are pro-singleness and pro-marriage. There's no extremism here. But there are certain gospel priorities which show a preference in ordering these things. So what we're going to be doing in this pro-singleness section is we're going to be familiarizing ourselves with why Paul thinks singleness is so great. Now, how many of you have heard the word eschatomania? Okay? Eschatomania is different to having what all Christians should have, which is an eschatological perspective. The word eschatos refers to end times or end things. You know, all the stuff that's going to happen when Jesus returns? That's the study of eschatology. Eschatomania describes those people who get into a manic state where there's a type of panic, where there's a type of overreaction to these realities, and all this frenetic activity starts to break out. They anticipate what they think is going to be an imminent return, and so they scramble. Some have been known to given up their jobs, sell their houses. Some have even moved to Mount Olivet so that they can get a front row seat to Jesus returning to come back to Mount Olivet in accordance with Zechariah 14. Paul gives advice to those who are betrothed. That's those who are engaged but are technically not married, still single. Showing that singleness is a worthy pursuit in light of the fact that this world is passing away. Do not confuse what Paul is saying here with a scatomania. Rather, he's saying we need to live in light of eternity. And there are bigger things which impact even great things now in an important way. So Paul is pro-singleness not because he is encouraging a scatomania, but by reminding us that this life is not all that there is. So the portion that we have before us is a stark reminder, and it's a reminder to those who are single, and it's a reminder to those who are married. This life is temporary, and we must all have this eternal perspective, and all live in light of these realities. So this is not a sermon for the singles only. This is a sermon for every single one of us here today. As we go through this section, we'll note Paul's advice and his motivations to the single, or rather the betrothed. Also, what we'll see is how Paul shows that the married life adds extra duties and responsibilities. These are not evil in and of themselves, but they do prevent the freedom of singleness to serve the Lord. And then finally, the third thing we'll be looking at is just how Paul gives guidance on how to make a decision around whether you should be single or not. So let's look at what Paul says about single service, beginning with verse 25. Now concerning the betrothed, I have no command from the Lord, but I give my judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. So, verse 25, we see changes topic again. If you've been following with what we've been doing in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, you'll remember that Paul began the chapter speaking about those who are single, those who are married, matters of divorce. Then Paul made a little detour last week where he looked at that main principle of remain as you are, applying it not only to domestic situations, your marital status, but to your racial status as well as your social status. And Paul returns now. He goes back to the issues that he began this chapter with, but with a slight focus on the betrothed. The word betrothed here in the Greek is the word parthenos. It's literally virgin. And it occurs throughout this passage. So every time you see the word betrothed, that's what underlies it in the Greek. Why have our English translations chosen the word betrothed? Because in verses 36 to 38, you'll see that there's a formal arrangement with these virgins, which is under consideration. So all of this goes under the banner of the betrothed. In the ancient world, betrothal was a formal contract between two parties. This contract was usually arranged by the fathers or the husbands. In the upper echelons of society, it could be a business agreement tied up with this. It could be the bringing together of two powerful families. There could be political motivations for these sorts of activities. Paul is addressing the single members of the congregation who are in this particular situation. They are engaged. They're wearing, if you like, their engagement ring. They're technically unmarried, but they are formally betrothed. Paul here also, you'll notice, reflects the traditional view that a person is a virgin until married. That's just a given. That's just an assumption that he works with throughout this text. The word virgin is applied mostly to females in the Bible, but it is also applied to males in places like Revelation 14, verse 4. Now, you'll notice that Paul says there is no command from the Lord concerning those in this type of situation, but as an apostle. And the reason there's no command is because Jesus didn't give a direct command. But now, as an apostle, he is going to give his spirit-filled advice to people in this situation. Does this mean you can take Paul's opinion lightly? Does this mean that there's nothing that we need to consider in his words? No. If you look right at the end at verse 40, Paul makes clear the weight of his advice when he says, "And I think that I too have the Spirit of God." And if you know what he says in 1 Corinthians 14, when he says to the prophets, if you have the Spirit of God, you need to listen to me, because he's an apostle. This bears weight. This is not irrelevant. This is not just throwaway advice. This is something we all have to wrestle and reckon with. Look at verse 26. I think that in view of the present distress, it is good for a person to remain as he is. Paul restates that principle that we dealt with last week. It is good for a person to remain as he is. Let's not get into that overreaction territory. But here he adds a motivation for why. Paul, so far in this chapter, has pushed back at all sorts of overreactions. Overreactions that have been driven by bad theology. Bad theology like marriage is unclean and will defile you, so don't get married. Wrong. Or marriage is defiling, so get divorced. Wrong. He's also pushed back at the need for an external ceremony like circumcision to be a good Christian. Wrong. Overreaction. Or he's pushed back at the fact that you need to stop being a slave to be a good Christian. Wrong. Pushed back at that as well. Well, here he's adding more to his thinking. The goodness of marriage is a gift from God. The sufficiency of the gospel apart from an external ceremony. The ability to be content and serve God even in slavery. He adds this reason now. The present distress. This is another reason, or here is a reason to remain single. The present distress. What does Paul mean by the present distress? There are a few views. Here they are. Firstly, there's the preterist view, which says that prophecy given by Jesus in the Olivet Discourse, where there's going to be the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, it's going to rumble throughout the then known world, and there's going to be all sorts of terrible things going on. Some people think that Paul is anticipating the fall of Jerusalem. And so that's why it's a bad time to marry. And what you'll notice about this suggestion is that it's a present distress. It's a short-term problem, and once this problem goes away, none of this advice holds anymore. I don't hold to that reason. Some suggest, and many commentators comment on this, that there was a terrible famine in the area of Corinth, a famine that deeply impacted the economy of Corinth, and so it would be a bad time to marry because it would be a hard time for a man to provide for his family. That's the second view. Some people think that there was an economic issue that Paul was worried about. Others suggest that maybe there was a growing pocket of persecution, you know, and you shouldn't have children and raise children in an environment where the persecution is going on. So don't marry because of persecution. Others think, well, Paul just believed that Jesus was going to come back probably tomorrow. And so he was just saying it's not even worth marrying because, you know, Jesus is coming back tomorrow. Don't even bother with it. The present distress, you know, I see the moon turning to blood. I see all sorts of signs of the times. And so it's any day now. Don't even bother getting married. All of these views, I believe, are incorrect. I agree with the commentators who point out that although there may be some local problem, like a famine, that Paul's thinking would view these merely as a birth pang, as lot of a larger picture that this age has a due date. We're living in the final chapter of history before Jesus comes again, and that should change the orientation of everything that we do and think. We'll double down on that later on when we get to verses 29 to 31. But basically, what he's saying is, whatever local distress is going on, it's there to remind you that we're living in a world that is passing away. And that should have a bearing upon how you live and how you make big life decisions. Verse 27. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek a wife. So Paul is simply restating what he's already said earlier. This is a repeat of what he's already said in verse 8. So there's not much more we need to say about it. But lest it come across as a command, look at verse 28. But if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a betrothed woman marries, she has not sinned. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. Paul repeats the sentiments he gave earlier. Not everyone has the gift of celibacy, and it is not sinful to marry. If your takeaway from this sermon today is it's a bad thing to marry, you've misunderstood me. Okay, you've misunderstood Paul. Marriage is a good gift. It's not a bad thing. As we compare marriage with singleness, we're not comparing good with bad. We're comparing good with better. Because we're defining better by freeness to serve the Lord. We'll say much more about that. So, here he unfolds why he gives the advice that he does. Those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you. I would spare you from worldly troubles. Marriage comes with a set of duties and cares that hinder one from having that extra freedom with which we can serve the Lord with our singleness. Marriage is not sinful or bad, but it does come with baggage. Now, it's blessed baggage, but it definitely comes with duties and cares. Anxieties is one of the words that we could use. Unless we think that Paul is catastrophizing marriage as if he's some sort of jaded bachelor, he goes on to make himself clear. Look at verse 29. This is what I mean, brothers. So now he reflects on what he meant earlier by the present distress. The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. For the present form of this world is passing away. And here you can see that Paul's not picking on the single. He's picking on everyone. Everyone has to honor the realities that we're living in. So here we see what's driving Paul. It's his eternal perspective. He says that the time has grown short. What does this mean? This is not Paul pretending to know the date of Christ's return. This is not Paul living under the delusion that he really thinks it could happen tomorrow in his own time. He says to the Thessalonians that the man of sin has not yet arrived. There's certain things that he knows still needs to happen, which haven't happened. So we mustn't accuse Paul of having that weird view that he thought it was going to be possibly tomorrow. From his perspective, that's not what he is saying here. This world, this life, even marriage, has a due date. It has a shelf life. It will not go on forever and ever. There is something else, something better, that is coming to replace it. Something which all of our compasses should be oriented to. Paul is giving advice in light of these realities. Not the usual things that those who do not have this hope live for. Those who don't have Jesus. Those who don't have the hope of heaven. Those who don't have the hope of a new creation. Those whose only life that they have, they think, is this life. What do they have to do? They have to make the most of it now. And they live like that, don't they? And so when they start getting older and they stop being able to enjoy pleasures as much, you know, their world is coming to an end. You know, or they can't have the money to do the things that they want to do. Their world is coming to an end. That's not the orientation of our lives. We know Christ is coming again to build a new creation. We await the coming of Christ who will judge all of his enemies, including Satan, sin, death. He'll recreate the world free from sin and suffering. And there we will receive consolation greater than any pain you can ever endure. Your comforts are going to be greater than your pains in the new creation. You'll receive more good and more gifts than you can ever hold in this life, in the next. And where life will not only be like the one that we have now, but without sin, we will have a life that will exceed this life. Now, in this life, we live for things like marriage and children. But there's no marriage and children in the new creation. Paul places these realities before us, and he shows us how they ought to impact our lives now. So the challenge for us this morning, folks, is this. Is this the way we woke up this morning? Is this the glasses that we put on? Is this the way we're making decisions? Are these the truths that are impacting us? So let's look at the various areas Paul addresses. If you're married, Paul says, these truths should so impact your life that it should look like you're not married. Now, what does that mean? What does that mean? Let's be clear. Paul is not saying that you should enter into some weird spiritual marriage arrangement. You know what a spiritual marriage is? It's when you live together in the same house under the same name, but you no longer have relations. You no longer share the same bedroom, and you no longer relate as husband and wife. That's called a spiritual marriage. And it's a wrong view of marriage. Paul is not promoting a spiritual marriage. He is not saying that you should refuse to fulfill the God-given duties and responsibilities of being a godly wife and husband. No, Paul is not contradicting what he has already said earlier in this chapter, that your body is not your own and you ought to fulfill certain duties towards one another, nor what he says in other places like Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3 and so on. What he's saying is this: this truth of eternity should so transform your marriage so as to reflect these realities, giving you new priorities. So what would this look like? Well, here's just an example. We all want a dream home, don't we? We all dream of owning our own property and making it look like that YouTube guy we like to watch, you know, who's built his own house with his own hands, and you know, there's that vlog that we all love to follow and see how this guy builds his own dream house. And so we all have this idea of that dream house. Now, I'm not against dream houses, by the way. But here's a suggestion as to how things could reorient. Think about that person, how they work, how they save, how they orient every single detail of their lives to focus in on the dream house. That's the dictating principle of every action, every sacrifice, every choice. The reason they get up in the morning is to go work on the house again. Okay? It is a controlling idea. They sacrifice all to achieve the great ideal of a magazine-worthy, vlog-worthy house. But the Christian realizes that we have a better, more permanent dwelling in heaven. That house is great, and we're not going to despise that house. But we've got something much, 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 much better kept in heaven for us. That means our lives will be different when we wake up in the morning and what shapes our decision making. We are freed from having to pursue the ideal of having our heaven on earth because we have permanent holdings which are somewhere else. The focus, the sacrifices that we would have made for something fleeting and ultimately irrelevant in the larger scheme of things is no longer that weight, that controlling anchor around our necks, stealing our time, stealing our resources, stealing focus that we could be giving to the Lord. Suddenly, that dream career that you would sacrifice even your family for is no longer the goal. Instead, you want something sustainable that will give you the liberty to serve God more. This perspective helps us to restrain ourselves from making idols of our work, idols of our houses, idols of anything in this life, including your spouse. It also helps us to be more content with imperfect situations, freeing us from the complaints and the frustrations that we so often obsess over because we're treating this life as if this is all there is. So coming back to the first admonition, let married couples live like this is not all there is. Like their marriage is not intended to be their heaven on earth. And as a partnership, allow sacrifices and inconvenience that enable you as a partnership to better serve the Lord. So your energy is not all turned in on one another, but together your energy is turned outward for the Lord. One of the things that John Newton said, you know, he was a man who came from a very sinful background, but there was one besetting sin that he felt he carried with him into his Christian walk. And that was that he made an idol out of his wife. So Paul is saying to someone like John Newton that those who are married live as though they're not married. Because we have something more important that should govern how we live. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying don't love your wife. Or your husband. You must. You better. In fact, you've got more work to do because you have to honor the Lord and you have to bear the troubles that Paul is talking about here. This is what he wants to spare you from. So if this is your lot and this is what you've chosen, good. It's good. It's a good thing to marry. But it does bring those extra duties and cares. So we must not neglect our spouses or allow the present problems in our marriage to go unaddressed. This is when Paul says, let the married live as though they're not married. If you've got communication problems in your marriage, this doesn't mean you've got license to not address them. You must bear those problems. All right, next, Paul talks about those who mourn as though they did not mourn. What does this mean? Is mourning sinful? No. Paul, in another place, says, mourn with those who mourn. He mourns the state of the church and a number of other things. What does he mean here by those who mourn as though they do not mourn? Are you not allowed to care about the loss of your loved ones? Do you have to pretend some sort of stoic indifference that it didn't impact you? That's not what Paul is saying. You're allowed to recognize the terrible hole that sin and death have made in your life. You're allowed to recognize that the world is not as God made it and to feel that pain and bring that pain to God as mourning. But many in the world today mourn their lost ones as a permanent loss. But that's not us as Christians. Many carry their scars so deeply and so permanently that it debilitates and cripples them. The Christian is someone who mourns knowing that tears will give way to joy. One day, God himself will take those tears and he will wipe them away. And every tear that you weep, he counts and he stores up in a bottle. God is not indifferent to your mourning. Do not think that God is indifferent to your mourning. God cares about your mourning. What Paul is saying here is not saying mourning doesn't matter. It matters. But it's not controlling. That's what he's saying. Because ordinarily you would expect that mourning, everything must stop. Because now I'm mourning. Mourning now takes the top priority above every other thing, even eating, even washing your hair, even shaving in the ancient world. Paul's saying no. There is still something much more important than even that honor that you want to pay to your most loved one. Because God is ultimately greater. And these realities are ultimately more important than the things of this life. Paul says, let those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice. What does that mean? Does that mean you're not allowed to be happy? Is Paul saying you shouldn't laugh? You shouldn't joke? You should walk around with a frown all day long? Is that what he's saying? Of course not. You know, God wants you to enjoy his good gifts and return it as gratitude and thanksgiving and worship back to him. So we're not to walk around with sullen faces refusing to be happy. Rather, Paul is saying the greatest joys to be had are not in this life. Any joys that you experience, be they first love, marriage, children, success, don't lose sight of the fact that these things will pass away. Don't be so smitten, so obsessed, so taken, so distracted by these things, as if they're the only things that exist, because there is something greater that does exist. Please hear me correctly. I'm not saying don't enjoy these experiences. You must enjoy them to the glory of God. In the proper balance that there is something still ultimately greater than even these wonderful things. This is what Paul is trying to impress upon us. Many have their identity and their ultimate satisfaction wrapped up in these things. Paul applies the same point to worldly possessions. Is this a call to give up all worldly possessions because ownership is sinful? Those who buy as though they did not own. Does it mean you're not allowed to own stuff? Is that what it means? Well, we've seen so far that you've got to get Paul's point in his words here. He's not saying that ownership is a sin. He's saying you need to recognize that this world's goods are not of ultimate importance. This is not where your treasure lies. These things will fade, moth and rust destroy. And so, if we lose our possessions, we don't lose our hope. We don't lose our minds. We don't lose our joy. When we want something, we do so with the realization that our hearts will only truly be satisfied in God and in the next life. And so even those things that you're looking for, you've probably experienced this. You know, anyone here ever had buyer's regret? You know, you planned for that thing that you were going to buy. You did all the research. guys do lots of research. And they, you know, then they go out, because the specs, you know, you need the best specs for the price. And so you go out and you get the best thing that you think is going to make you happy, and you get it, and it's sort of just that little underwhelming thing. You know, it's just like the shine goes off it pretty quick. You know, exactly. Because this isn't where our ultimate joy is. It's in the next life. Paul also talks about those who have dealings with the world. This is possibly business dealings, as though they had no dealings with the world. Now, once again, this is not saying you shouldn't own a business, or that you shouldn't do business deals, or that you shouldn't seek to be the best in your field if you own a business. Paul's not saying that. Paul's saying you have other ultimate priorities. You can make these things. You can be a good Christian witness in your business dealings to the glory of God, and you ought to be. But you can't live as if they are the most ultimate things, because we have something else in our sights. At least we ought to have them in our sights. We could apply this to every area of life, couldn't we? What do you have that you should live like it is not the most ultimate thing in this universe? That's what Paul is saying. He's trying to help you orient your life. And for the single person, what's the biggest need they think they have? To get married. Paul's saying, good news for you. It is a need, and it's a God-given need. And it's not a sin to fill that need. But it's not your ultimate need. There are options. So, we do not despise these things. We are merely remembering that this world is passing away. So hear me carefully. Paul is not despising the world. Paul is not demonizing the world. Paul is not saying, depart from this world. Paul is saying, put this world in perspective, in light of eternity. For Paul, the truth about new creation is not only a comfort, it also has a bearing on how we live our lives today. It's not only a promise for when we die, but a motivation for how we live today. So here's the challenge. Do you live in light of eternity? Do you live in light of eternity? Are you putting too much value in things that are passing away, that ultimately, in the final scheme of things, do not matter? Is your sense of happiness or sadness dictated by things that will fail or in things that cannot fail? Does the truth of what we have in Christ shape everything about you? What do you need to change to reflect these realities? This is the challenge for all of us. Let's look at Paul's challenge with regards to marital duties. Verse 32. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to please the Lord. Now, Paul is explaining why he is seriously recommending singleness. He points out that being married will bring many anxieties, worries, cares, same word. But the single person can have different anxieties. He can be anxious about the things of the Lord. Verse 33 and 34. But the married man is anxious about worldly things, how to please his wife, and his interests are divided. And the unmarried or betrothed woman is anxious about the things of the Lord, how to be holy in body and spirit. But the married woman is anxious about worldly things, how to please her husband. And the word worldly there is literally things of the flesh. And it's a neutral reference. It's not a sinful reference. You know, the pew you're sitting on is worldly in the sense that it's in this world. It's not sinful. Yeah, that's what worldly means. The word is used in several senses in Scripture. Marriage is not bad. It's not bad because it defiles you, therefore you should divorce. Paul's already answered that problem. Marriage is not bad and is somehow a capitulation for the weak. Paul's not saying that either. Marriage is a gift of God, and it comes full of responsibilities. So that those who seek to do it well will have to sacrifice much in terms of time and care and fulfilling their responsibilities. Some have described what Paul is saying here in terms of a syllogism. Here's a syllogism. Major premise. Less anxiety over worldly matters means one can be more undivided in their devotion to the Lord. Minor premise. Being unmarried means having less anxieties with regards to worldly affairs. Conclusion. The unmarried life, which leaves us freer from worldly cares, frees us up to be more undivided in our devotion to the Lord. It's a very simple, logical process that Paul is going through. As I said earlier, Paul is not comparing good with bad. You know, there's singleness, that's the good, and marriage is the wicked evil. No. He's comparing good with the best for those who are able. If you don't have the gift of celibacy, this is not an option for you. This is your best. Your best is marriage. But if you have the gift of celibacy, then you have a second option. It's possible that you are being called to a life of fuller service as a single person. Verse 35. I say this for your own benefit, not to lay any restraint upon you, but to promote good order and to secure your undivided devotion to the Lord. Can you hear Paul's heart? All he wants for people is to give as much as they can to God. He wants God to get all the glory from your lives. And he's unapologetic about that. Now, despite Paul's advice to pursue the best of single service, not only the good of marriage, we mustn't fail to see that Paul does expect married people to invest in their marriages, to fulfill their responsibilities. So let's stop and let's take note of that for a moment. A husband, because he is married, must please his wife. A wife, because she is married, must please her husband. You must. Feel the weight of that. Do not get the impression that marriage is an inconvenience, that marriage is something you've got to put up with, that marriage is somehow unimportant or is somehow diminished by anything that Paul is saying. No. There are still marital obligations that must be fulfilled. It is a God-given institution that comes with duties and responsibilities. So, husband, is your wife pleased? Do you have a happy wife? Wives, is your husband happy? Do you have a happy husband? Husbands, does your wife receive sufficient affection from you? Encouragement from you? Do you give her security? Do you communicate with her? Do you give her your willingness to do jobs around the house? Or do you broadcast passive resistance? Are you a partner in parenting? Are you present? Do you smile at her? Do you give her kind words? Do you give her gifts? Do you give her freedom from some chores and responsibilities to pursue hobbies and interests and spend time with her friends? Do you give her your listening ear and full attention? Does she have money that is her own to spend how she would like to spend it? Are you a husband who is clean and keeping himself in decent shape for his wife? Wives, are you giving your husband sufficient affection? Are you giving him the support that he needs as the leader in your home? Are you giving him verbal affirmation? Men have fragile egos and they need encouragement. Just no matter what they say, tell them they did a great job. Tell them they're amazing. They need it. Okay? Do you give your man space for downtime to spend time in the man cave? Are you being the helper that he needs in running the home? Are you giving him your respect and submission? Are you being the happy wife who creates an environment of lightness in the home? Or is it an atmosphere of hen pecking and walking on eggshells? Are you a wife who pays attention to her appearance, seeking to be attractive to her husband? These are your duties and your cares. These are the things that you must care about and you must put effort into and you must pursue. This is your duty. And rightly so. Paul says, good, go do all that stuff. The single person, on the other hand, is not burdened with the responsibility to do all these things, but instead can lay up their timetable with all sorts of other stuff for the Lord's purposes. And so we have to, here is the question for the singles. Are you sanctifying your singleness and using it for the Lord? This is a precious commodity. Every single one of us is single at some time in our lives. And we all have to spend our singleness well. Today, there is many a young man who's consumed with video games who can't wait for the weekend because he can do an all-nighter because he hasn't got work the next day. Or he can binge-watch his favorite Netflix. Yeah? Is this good stewardship of our singleness? If you're single, take Paul's teaching to heart. The time is short. How are you going to proactively use it to serve the Lord? Even if you don't have the gift of celibacy, you still have an opportunity anytime you're single to serve the Lord in this way. There are so many things that we could be doing with our singleness. There are jobs around the church that need doing. There are elderly folk that need visiting. There are meals that need to be made. There's wood that needs to be chopped. There are work parties for people's property that can be volunteered into. There are those who need to identify newcomers and practice hospitality and make the newcomer feel welcome and include them in their friend circle. There are so many ways we can use our singleness for the Lord. And then we come to the final section where Paul talks about making decisions. Look at verses 36 to 38. If anyone thinks that he is not behaving properly toward his betrothed, if his passions are strong and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. Let them marry. It is no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having his desire under control, and has determined this in his heart to keep her as his betrothed, he will do well. So then, he who marries his betrothed does well, and he who refrains from marriage will do even better. So Paul brings the matters back on track to the issue of those who are betrayed. Should they stay single, or should they marry? What he does here is he outlines the key principles by which we need to make this decision. Now, I foolishly, as a young man, made a rash vow to be single. Okay? Don't make a rash vow. There is forgiveness for rash vows. The Bible makes provision, Leviticus 5, and so on. But Paul puts forward some very important principles to help you think through whether you have this gift and whether this is the decision that you need to make. Not everyone can make this decision, but here are the principles that should guide those who can. Firstly, there's another party involved. Are you doing right by your betrothed? What do they think? By the way, dear, I'm committing myself to celibacy, but we're engaged. yeah. So, are you doing right by your betrothed? What do they think? There's another person in this situation. And you have to take that other person into account. So Paul is not just saying this is your decision alone, because there is some sense of obligation by virtue of the betrothal, which needs to be taken into account. Secondly, Paul recognizes that not all are gifted for celibacy and struggle with lust. He is realistic about this and does not pretend everyone can ignore this issue. And he says, are you struggling with this? If you are, then don't be foolish. Don't try and commit yourself to what you can't do. Thirdly, he underlines that this decision has to be made within their own hearts. Is this your decision? Is this coming from an outward pressure? Is this coming from a false idea of zeal? Are you imitating your favorite hero from church history? Is this your decision from your own heart between you and the Lord? And fourthly, they should realize that marriage is not sinning at all and that this is a matter of recommendation and not a commandment. Only then should they commit to celibacy. But let me turn it over for a moment. When I was seriously considering celibacy with a more informed theology later on in my Christian walk, and I debated whether I, as someone who felt a deep call to go into mission work or pastoral ministry, and I had to make a decision, should I marry? Here is what helped me make the decision. As a pastor, I would be a better pastor for being married. I would have a wife and I would understand how marriages ought to work and be able to preach more effectively on marriage. I would have children, and I would be more familiar with all the ins and outs of child rearing and be more effective in being able to preach on these matters. Are you in a situation where marriage will make you a better Christian, not celibacy? So that freed me, because I'm a man with a tender conscience who thought I should always try to do the hard thing to be the good Christian. But I realized that marriage would make me the better Christian. Will marriage make you the better Christian? So don't have a false sense of legalism around this issue of celibacy. My experience is that 99% of those who think they have the gift of celibacy don't. 99%. So if you think you might have this gift, please talk to an older Christian. Feel free to talk to your elders. We'd love to have a chat with you about these things. This is not a decision to be made lightly. Unfortunately, I've found those who make the decision for all the wrong reasons. Those who are on the rebound. Coming out of a bad relationship. Coming out of a deep emotional hurt. Who don't want to be hurt again. Who, as a reaction to a bad relationship, think, I'm going to go be celibate. That's a bad reason. Or if someone's been sexually abused in the past, they think they hate men or women or whatever the case is. That person needs counseling. They mustn't pretend that they're celibate. They mustn't just ignore the problem. They should address the problem and then, from a place of being healed and ministered to, decide what path they're going to take. Okay? We need to be very careful about being overreactionary in these issues. Marriage is a gift from God. It is a good thing. And we mustn't feel that Paul recognizes there's only a few select with this gift that should consider this as their whole life. Paul ends out his advice on marriage and singleness with a word about widows, saying what we have already stated, that marriage is not sin, singleness is better, and remarriage only in the Lord is fine. Verse 38, 39 to 40. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Yet in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is, and I think I too have the Spirit of God. So, what is the takeaway from these verses? The time is short. Live like eternity is true. Married or unmarried, we are all challenged today to have this eternal perspective. Let me end with maybe a word about Christ, because I think his example is the best. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. That is how each one of us runs our race. For the joy of the new creation, for the joy of having saved sinners as his people, he as king lived like he was not king. He as rich lived like he was not rich. He lived with this eternal perspective in mind, and we follow our Savior in that attitude. Let's pray.